We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 19. The purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming Black real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors. Shout out to our sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. You can become a member of their network for free at mintinc-usa.com. You can also follow them on IG at mintinc_USA. Several announcements before we get into this episode today. Don't forget to leave us a rating and a comment. It will help us reach more people, help us move up in the rankings. Thank you so much to everyone who has rated us and left such thoughtful comments. We really appreciate your support. We're also on Twitter. You can follow us at Bred Podcast, at BRED Podcast. Take a moment to follow us there. Interact with us throughout the day. We interact a lot more on Twitter through comments and retweets and such. And it's a different vibe than Instagram, which we're also on all the time, every day. Also, sign up for our email list. By signing up for our list, you'll get discounts from our partners, additional content, resources. We released our newsletter recently, which was really great. We had some awesome resources that can help you on the path to homeownership and real estate investment. And we always send out emails when our partners have offers that you can take advantage of. You can also purchase our merch at gum.co/bread. We're getting a lot of great reviews on the merch and looking forward to continuing to represent the brand and spread awareness of it. Very excited for this episode with Charm City Buyers. I know you'll all get a whole lot out of it. So let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Here with me, I have Kiara and Khalil from Charm City Buyers. They are out of Baltimore, Maryland. Super excited to speak with them today. Been following you two for a while. So very glad that we have an opportunity to interview you.
Yay, thank you. Thanks for having us.
For sure. So first, I would just love each of you to talk about what your childhoods were like and what you saw or what you didn't see that shaped your view of building wealth.
Yeah, so my childhood, I was definitely, I didn't want for much, right? So it was both my parents, middle to times upper middle class, to be completely honest. So I don't necessarily have the rags to riches story, but my upbringing was surrounded by family, so it was a lot very family oriented. And growing up, I watched our community change and continue to change as I'm a country girl, so as farms were sold and new housing developments were put up. And so lots of new houses, and watching kind of communities change and shifts and people move in, and how did that impact how, you know, life was prior. And so that was a big part of my upbringing was, you know, we definitely had an abundance mindset, right? I was raised to, you know, you do what you wanna do so you can, you do what you gotta do so you do what you wanna do. So all about hustle and figuring out how you make happen what you want to happen.
Yeah, dope. My upbringing was very much, you know, I was the youngest of seven, Brady Bunch type of family, where it was just little bit of everybody type of deal. You know, we had a relatively small, modest house. I'd say if you say like middle to upper, I'd say middle to lower class. A lot of hand-me-downs. I got two brothers who are just 1 and 2 years older than me. So it was just up until ninth grade, it was whatever they got is what I got next. No name brand stuff or anything like that. So we learned to play a lot of financial defense. Mm-hmm. So we learned how to save and cherish the things that you did get because you didn't get a whole lot. We got enough to make us happy and smile. But the things that we did get, held on to them forever. And cherished them and really nurtured them and made sure that they were special to you, to me. The financial defense kind of goes far and beyond what I'm up to now and how I've kind of learned to save and delay the gratification for as long as possible until you get to a place where you don't have to delay it anymore. And it helped to springboard quite a few things that we have going on now.
For sure. So how did you two decide that you wanted to invest in real estate and that's what you wanted to use as one of the vehicles to work towards building wealth?
So yeah, we had a bunch of different options and we had kind of a checklist at one point. Is it community oriented? Is it long-term residual income that you have to work for, but it's a different type of work. It's maybe fewer hours in a week. Is it something that is, you know, generational wealth and you can pass down and, you know, quite a few things check all three of those boxes, but real estate is the one that really resonated the most with Kiara.
Yeah, we like sat down and said, okay, you know, we were fresh out of college, so still really, really young, still boyfriend and girlfriend or whatever. Yeah. And so it was like, all right, you know, here's where I see myself and what I need and what I think I want, you know, long-term for myself and what he was looking for long-term for himself. And we kind of sat down, all right, what are those things that we need to accomplish to make those things happen together if that's where this is going? And so that's what really spurred the whole thing in real estate is like, what makes sense for you? What makes sense for me? Okay, how do we do this thing together? And real estate worked. And real estate was actually something that I had always been passionate about, that same kind of story around watching houses being developed and watching transformations happen was something I was really passionate about and knew that I wanted to do. And so it's something that I presented to Chloe as an opportunity as we looked at other things. And, you know, at the end of the day, it ended up being something that made the most sense for us both.
For sure. I think it's very interesting that you mentioned just growing up and seeing a lot of the new development that was happening around you. What was that like for you? Did you wonder why you weren't participating in that or why it was happening? What was that experience like as a kid?
Yeah, so as a kid, I mean, for me, it was more so like, you know, we would ride around and be like, mommy, we should buy this house, right? So I was trying to figure out how to get in and how to participate. And for me, I think at the time, I knew I would point out houses that I want my parents to buy, and I told them to buy Google and Amazon stock on an IPO, and I didn't have the money personally to do that, right?
You're ahead of the game.
I was trying to get, yeah, right. I tried to put them on, but you know, it didn't work out that way. And I think for me at that time, it kind of solidified a few things. One, that I wanted to always have the option to do what I wanted to do. I always want to feel like I will put myself in the position to be able to pull the trigger when I say or think that I want to do something, to be completely honest. And so I think it just kind of lit a bit of a fire in and within me personally to say, you know, when there are opportunities, I need to, you know, stay ready so I don't have to get ready. And so when things pop up, I'm able to adjust and take advantage of opportunities as they come.
For sure. And can you walk us through what that first purchase looked like?
Yeah, so our first purchase was not in Baltimore, although most of our investments and all of our attention is in Baltimore now, where I'm born and raised. And but we bought a 3-unit shell in Hartford, Connecticut. We had a construction loan through a nonprofit that helped us to fund the construction. We did a tax credit, which was pretty interesting, keeping our property taxes low because it was a blighted and vacant property. $120,000 later, we had three units all fully rented and leased up and cash flowing nicely.
Nice. That's awesome. Can you, the nonprofit thing, can you talk more about that? And how
it really helped? It's an opportunity that a lot of people kind of overlook or just naturally don't know about because people get so comfortable in just the traditional ways of doing real estate and even the traditional thought process around OPM, right? And so nonprofits, there are nonprofit community and residential developers all over the country that are really focused on redeveloping certain communities all over. And so what happened was the neighborhood and area that we were investing in was actually a target location for this nonprofit. And so we were networking, we were telling our story, we were trying to position ourselves for funding or to potentially sell. We're talking about wholesaling that house. It's kind of a whole other story.
Yeah.
And so we connected with them and they bought into our vision of investing in forgotten neighborhoods and turning vacant houses into homes. And so they ended up working with us for that renovation of the property.
Wow, that's incredible. For me, that what that says to me is the fact that at that time, even though it was the first purchase, you're already forward thinking because, you know, you're seeing property or neighborhood, perhaps that's forgotten. And also, you know, telling your story while you're still, you know, pretty new to the game at that particular point. And lo and behold, the funds and resources came to you. I think that's very, very cool.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, that's for sure. And then, you know, there are moments in the first one where you're scared and you don't quite know how it's going to pan out, but you stay, keep your foot on the gas, you keep pushing it. And then eventually, you know, the universe will send somebody to help you along your way.
For sure. And what were some of the scary moments during that experience?
Yeah. Buying the property was scary.
Right, all of it, right? So we were fresh out of college. I was maybe a year out. You were,
about 2 years out.
You were almost 2 years out. And so we were super young. We bought a vacant shell. So our very first deal was a $120,000 renovation.
Wow.
And neither of one of us come from families of developers or anything like that. It was just us leaning on each other and figuring it out. And so there was tons of moments where we were like, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean, we planned on wholesaling the property. That's when we realized that it was in a neighborhood that, you know, a bigger pockets or someone like that would say, don't invest in. And so we couldn't quite find someone to wholesale it to. And we're like, forget it. Forget that. Like, this neighborhood deserves nice quality homes. And so we decided that we were going to figure out how to do that ourselves. And really, I think for us, we were kind of too young to be scared enough to not do it, right? And I remember having a conversation where we were like, man, if all goes left, we'll figure it out. Like, we'll just keep working, you know, like, you know, we saved up cash. And so we'll just have to rebuild our savings and figure it out. And so we were ambitious and just ambitious enough to make it work and make it happen.
For sure. It's interesting. I think something a lot of people get caught up on is just being scared or what's going to happen. And believe it or not, just in a lot of areas in life, you just have to do something and you kind of just learn from there, and nothing's ever going to be perfect. So, you know, you start somewhere and then you just kind of refine as you go.
Absolutely.
It's like being an entrepreneur is like learning how to fly as you're building the plane.
I like that.
And that's how we started. Literally, we figured it out as we went, and we learned a lot from that very first deal that we applied to every single deal afterwards. So it was tons of learnings, but at the end of the day, we realized that done was better than perfect. And so we took action and figured it out and learned from our mistakes and kept it moving.
Absolutely. What are two follow-up questions? What were some of the things you learned from that experience? And then how did things grow from there?
We learned how to pay better attention, closer attention to the numbers, I guess, and making sure we understand the numbers and the deal and the structure, how we're buying deals and what the exit strategies are. We really learned how to analyze deals a lot better after that one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Analyzing deals, that's a good one. And we learned construction. We learned the construction process. What are some of the pieces that go into large renovations? We learned not to be afraid of construction as well. So when you start with a $120,000 renovation, there's not too much that scares you after that. Yeah. Although we have upped the ante with the level of renovations that we do, but we weren't afraid of numbers. We weren't afraid of big construction deals. And we're able to kind of learn through that process that we use every single day now.
Amazing. Amazing. So what happened after that? Like where did the portfolio and everything grow from that point?
Yeah. So we moved to Baltimore. Actually sometime during the phase of that first deal, because I was having Michaela. And so we moved to Baltimore and we weren't here for more than maybe 3 or 4 months before we bought our first one in Baltimore. So we just kept it moving. Wow. We decided not to let the momentum slow down. We continued to pour into investing here. And what happened when we got to Baltimore was like, wow, there's so much opportunity. And even thinking about Baltimore now versus then, Baltimore's changed so much. And so we were like, you know, there's so much opportunity here. We have to get on the ground floor. Like Baltimore is changing, it's shifting, like we have to buy now. And so that's kind of how we started in Baltimore. And then as we did that, we're like, wow, we really need to make sure people know and understand how amazing Baltimore is, how much opportunity and potential there is, and really strive to create the community that we didn't have when we first started. And that's how kind of things grew and multiplied here in Baltimore.
Yeah. I think one thing about us, we've never had a chance to really sit and just like enjoy what we've built. on to the next one, bigger and better, bigger, stronger. Yeah. And it puts a little bit of pressure as you close. It's like, oh snap, now I have to go to work and put this thing together, put the deal together, keep the guys moving and sell it or rent it. And then we do another one and we keep on pushing ourselves as hard as we possibly can. And that's, again, because we started young. Mm-hmm. We got so much energy and so much spirit. And because we were able to achieve so much at such a young age, we love giving it forward and paying it forward and making sure that others are aware that this is absolutely an option that can become a reality.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And what did that first deal in Baltimore look like? Was it similar? Was it a shell and a full renovation again?
It wasn't quite as bad. It was a smaller property, so it required less. But we did use some creative tactics, like in the first one. Again, the first one, tax credit and nonprofit funding. The second one, we used private money lending and seller financing. So we combined those two strategies together. We didn't have to come to the closing table with any cash. The private money came with half of it. The seller held half of it, and we got it up and running with our own cash infusion into the construction part of it, and then the tenant paid the mortgage and some, along with the first one, kind of waterfalling and or snowballing, whatever term everybody uses nowadays, cash flowing.
We used funding from the three unit because we were able to have that influx as we needed it for construction, renovation, whatever it was in the property in Baltimore. We just kind of, like Will said, snowballed or waterfall. I can't remember what we usually say. I think it's snowballed the money from that property into the next. And then we just kept doing that. Like we kept just funneling funds from one property into the next so that we were able to build a portfolio while at the time we were both still working full time.
For sure. And there's a couple of things I'm noticing here. So the first is wherever you two were, you thought about the possibilities of what could be in the area that you're in or the area that you invested in, which I think is great. And, I think just generally people will be a lot more successful too if they adopt that kind of mentality. Because if we think about it, in our communities, these days around the country, especially, change is happening. It has been the last 10 or so years in a lot of Black and brown communities all over the country. But there are other people who come in and they see what it could be. They see what it could be. And, you know, they renovate the homes or they build new development. And we could participate if, of course, if we had the knowledge, but if we also had that vision. So I think it's really great. And then secondly, the fact that you took that action in the beginning provided, like you said, provided some cash to support the next move. And I think it was so important that you took that first action, and it seems like, you know, things kind of have built from there.
That's a great observation. That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's really important that we see the opportunity and potential in our neighborhoods first, right? I think a lot of times it's really easy to kind of, you know, you get jaded by where you're from sometimes, mm-hmm. to be honest. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, trying to take that outside perspective, or even I think it's really important to like get away and come back, like whether that means you're going to college and then you actually come back, right? A lot of times we go to college and then never come back. I think that gives you a new perspective on potential and opportunity, and we miss it a lot of times. And that's one of the things that Khalil and I are super passionate about, is sharing our passion for Baltimore, because a lot of times it turns this light bulb on, like, oh yeah, like you're right. Baltimore does have the best restaurants and tons of really great jobs. And there's all these young professionals moving into the city, and there's a lot of shifts happening. And sometimes you just need someone else to plant the seed to really be able to see it and turn on that light. And so we're like all about shouting Baltimore from the rooftops, because not only do we want to make sure that people that are here see what's around them, but also those who are open and willing to add value in the communities in which they invest, we want them here too, right? And we want to make sure that as Baltimore continues to change and shift, we are helping to position people to win. And so when you think about the DCs, the Brooklyns, the Harlems, all these different cities where we as a community of Black and brown primarily areas weren't in positions of property ownership to be able to really ride that wave like we could have or should have, and we weren't really in positions of power through ownership to be able to dictate what that change looks like. And that's what we spend a lot of our time, that's what 2020 honestly is dedicated to as Baltimore is changing, that we are positioning people and entities and organizations and whomever to be in a successful place, or a place of success as Baltimore changes, and they have a say in what that change actually looks like.
Absolutely, absolutely. Then I know you mentioned for that first deal, there was private money involved and seller financing, and those are two hot topics, two things that people seem to are either confused about or want to learn about. So can you talk about how you were able to structure the deal in that way with the private money and the seller financing, and how it all worked out for you?
Yeah, so for the private money, we typically work through, you can either work through debt or equity are the two main returns that a private money lender can capture. But before I even go down that hole, what is a private money lender? It's somebody who you know in your personal network or your professional network who has cash. They're not a professional lender, but they have saved up or have accumulated a certain amount of cash, and they want to deploy it in a way that gives them cash back along with their principal. So it could be a doctor, a lawyer, it could be a family friend, it could be your rich uncle or auntie, whomever. But it's just somebody in your network with cash. And how they convert from just a person with money to a private money lender is that you position them and say, hey, I've got an investment opportunity, or I'm getting into real estate, or I've got a ton of mentors behind me who know this stuff. We want to work together on a house with you. So if you put your cash in, we put our time and our expertise in, we can put this thing back to life. We can stabilize this property, and you can get your return, whether that's, again, debt or equity. So for this deal particularly, it was a debt transaction. We do all of our private money structures with debt. and that person got a return and they were pretty happy with it. The house cost about 26 grand. The private money lender put up about 15. So the seller financer held about, 14? That's the difference?
It was like 16 and 8, but it doesn't really doesn't matter that much. So the point is that the private lender was a long time ago.
Yeah. So five, six years ago.
That private lender was put up some and was able to get an interest return. And then for the seller financing, we asked the question. We were looking at the property, we're like, would you be willing to sell or finance and hold the note? People don't understand how easy it is to really do a lot of these creative strategies. It's really just you asking the question a lot of times. And so we asked if they would sell or finance. They said yes. And so we structured that. So it was a 3-year monthly payment. So we paid off the property in 3 years with the seller financier. So it was really great. And then we were able to just put our funding into the construction.
Wow, that's awesome. And then from there, did you refinance out of that property?
No, we paid it off.
You said you paid it off.
Yep. So we paid it off in the 3 years. So then we had it free and clear.
Now houses are selling in that area. A year ago, they were selling for 175. We saw one in the area sell for about 185. I think it was 185, a couple blocks down. Mm-hmm. So it was a great investment. And at the time, bringing up a point that Kiara spoke on earlier, when you're from the area, it's like, no, don't
invest over there.
Yeah, you don't think about that type of stuff. So when I was growing up and listening to Baltimore club music and going down to Paradox and Hammerjacks and things like that, I remember hearing about this neighborhood and these club songs.
Yep.
I'm like, no, we're not buying a property over there. But then Kiara took a step back, not being from here, and she said, look, I can see Johns Hopkins from here. I can see one of the major parks from here. This is absolutely an area where in a short amount of time, the property values are going to go up. And her vision and her ability to really foresee a couple short years later, we bought this in 2013. And the property value has gone up almost 5 times. For her to see that is just a testament to her ability to spot deals and one of her strengths.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then from there, did you grow your portfolio within that particular neighborhood, or did you target certain neighborhoods? What was the strategy after getting your foot into the Baltimore market?
Yeah, like at that point, we weren't really, we hadn't narrowed down yet. So we were buying properties all over. We were just looking for great deals. So we continued to look for great deals and scoop up really good opportunities. And so we were kind of scattered for a while for our rental properties until kind of fast forward over the last few years or so, we've narrowed down a little bit more and tried to be a little bit more intentional about what it was that we were trying to accomplish and how.
For sure, for sure. And at this point, where does the portfolio stand? Around how many units do you all have in the altogether?
Mm-hmm. So we have about 20 rental units, and then we have like 5 active rehab projects of our own. Chloe also is like a developer.
Yeah, we provide construction management services where we help others with their projects and bring our team along to make sure that it's done right the first time and mm-hmm. high quality.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of projects going all over the place.
Yeah, we're in control of a lot of development that's happening.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful. It's great. And it's not something that we do alone. It's not something that we're, we're very modest and humble about it, but we love being able to help other people.
But we're kind of a big deal.
No. Oh, I know. I've been watching.
we love being able to infuse ourselves into people's projects and help them bring them to life.
Yeah.
For sure. And that transitions perfectly into the next segment. So I know you two do a lot. I know you have NextGen, you have the Mobilize Baltimore events, you mentioned the development. That you all do. I know that's just the tip of the iceberg. So I would love for you just to share with our listeners the different things that you're doing within Baltimore to continue to grow your portfolio, but also to help the community and to help others tap into it as well.
Yeah, right now we've kind of really been focused on, because we have large construction projects that we're doing. So we haven't been doing really for the last few months or so a lot of buying ourselves, but more so supporting the purchases and portfolio growing of all of our next gen accelerator folks. So the next gen accelerator is our baby. That's my passion project. Honestly, I think next gen is really aligned with my purpose, but in NextGen, we are really helping and supporting new and current investors in starting and growing their portfolio and investing in Baltimore successfully. And so we're sharing like the nuts and bolts of investing, going through the full entire investing cycle, and really with the goal that within 6 months, folks are buying property. And so they're buying property in Baltimore, whether a house that they're going to live in and house hack, or a rental property or a construction project or a flip or a wholesaling. Like, we're working with folks doing all types of things here in Baltimore, again, to help position people for success as Baltimore continues to change. So there are our mentees, they literally call us mom and dad. But that's where, you know, we're spending a lot of our time, is really supporting and pushing folks forward so that they can invest in real estate better, faster, and smarter than we did. At the end of the day, I think what's important and something that we've always been really focused on is generational wealth, right? And not just for us, for other people, because we want our daughter to have people that look like her and move like her, who can, you know, understand these types of concepts and have this similar experience to her, and legacy. And I think that legacy for us is going to be a lot bigger than us, right? It's going to be Baltimore. It's going to be all of our mentees. We have, you know, NextGen right now is bringing in $1 million a year in rental income. You know, they're killing it. And so thinking about how much wealth has been generated and cash flow and lives are being changed is really, really humbling. And so through this year, our goal is that NextGen's buying 220 units in 2020. So we are like amping up the support and the resources and growing the family, because we want to make sure that, you know, people have that seat at the table.
Yep.
For sure. And can you talk more about the construction and the development side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we first started out, we were, we kind of coined ourselves as investors, like most people do. And then later in the game, you kind of learn that investors are the ones who put the cash in, and the people who do the work and kind of see this thing happen are the rehabbers or flippers of the real estate game. On a larger scale, when you start adding in the community and looking at the different amenities that the neighborhood offers and how you can kind of reshape things and strategically rehab houses in a way that that continues the growth in a very positive fashion, that's when you get into the development space. Mm-hmm. We are really developing communities and developing neighborhoods and developing people.
Rather than rehabbing houses
or yeah. flipping houses.
Yep.
So the development space is one that you know, we've started to get into. We're about 2 or 3 years into it now. And it's a lot of fun. It's really where the rubber meets the road. The flipping and rehabbing phases, where you kind of learn it, you knock your head around a bit, you decide whether or not it's for you. And then if it is for you and you're ready to take it to the next level, that development state is what's absolutely next. And that's where community associations are involved, for-profits, nonprofits, large, small, city, state, municipalities. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of these kind of stakeholders all come together and say, okay, strategically, where do we need a grocery store? Or strategically, should we do this block of rehabs or should we do that block of rehabs? And how can we position those houses to be fixed as quickly as possible? That development space, I like that word a lot better. It resonates a lot more with me.
For sure. And I know you mentioned a lot about the city and municipalities and such, and I've seen it. Seems like you two are very involved on the ground with the city at the city level. So can you talk more about how that aspect impacts development and investment? Because I think that can be a blind spot for a lot of people. And a lot of times we just think about, you know, I'm going to buy a house, we're rent it out, but we don't, we don't, it's not innate to think about the other factors that impact a community and the direction that things are going in. So I'd love for you two to share a bit more with us about that.
It's tough in our community. Historically, there's been such a distrust from us towards the government, whether that's from us to police officers or us towards the legal system and a whole bunch more. I'm sure we could go down a rabbit hole and talk for days about that. But the government's role is to help bring about positive change, right? That's just one piece of it. Mm-hmm. Another way to think about it is that your city has a business responsibility to promote the city and promote the city very well to its buyers. And its buyers are its owners, its homeowners, its commercial owners, those people who are paying property taxes back to the city or income taxes back to the city. And for the city to increase its property taxes and its income taxes and all the other tax bases, they have to eliminate blighted property. They have to sell homes. They have to provide an incentive for people to move in. They've got to provide amenities that are better than any other city or more creative or have a very specific niche or use its geographic position to the best of its ability. So when you're looking at the city as that type of lens, not just like a city, but as a vehicle of change and a vehicle of growth, and how can I help the city to thrive, and you understand what the city's needs are, that's where you start to really find yourself as a partner at the table instead of somebody who just lives here.
For sure. And what would your suggestion be to someone who wants to get more involved and wants to be at the table, and when those kind of decisions are being made in their respective city, what should their first step be?
Yeah, step number one would definitely be to connect with the community association in your neighborhood. So when a developer like us wants to come in and do some massive change or deploy millions of dollars into your neighborhood, if opportunity zone funding is coming into your hood, they're going to stop at the community association first, because that's going to be a gatekeeper to different incentives and opportunities through the cities or through the state. They're going to say, well, what does the community association in that space want, or what do they need, or what did they say when you presented to them? And so a lot of these conversations start in the community association. And so anyone from a Harlem, a Brooklyn, a DC, or whatever, when change was coming and change was starting to happen, they probably also noticed that the community association started to change. And so when we started to not have as much power in our community association, we didn't have as much power in say on what was happening and how. And so we can't sleep on our community associations. Like, we have to be involved. So even if you don't own a block of properties or whatever, that is a place of power, is to not only be involved in your community association as a member, but even participating on the board is going to give you tons of insight on what's happening, not only in your neighborhood, but in the city at large. So that participation is huge.
That's big. That's big. I know, in a lot of communities around the country, we're worried about losing power. We're worried about not having influence on the direction certain things are going. So I'm really glad you mentioned that, that's a way people can get involved and, be part of the change and be aware and be able to tell others. So I really think it's great that you two are involved in that level. And of course, helping other people find out too.
No question. That's the first thought. You got to be part of the community association or be somehow involved in the community. The community is who votes for the local politicians, the local council person, all the way up to the mayor and the governor and everybody. So that's where their power is, in the vote. And I don't want to go down that path either, but it's a nice little round structure where if a developer wants to come in or somebody, an investor wants to come in, they got to stop past the community association, because the community association determines who the local politicians are and what the rules are, that the developer has to then listen to and follow. Right. So that's really where the power is.
Sure. And what are some challenges that you faced on the development side of things?
Challenges are going to be everywhere, right? So it depends on what stage of development you're in. It depends on who the stakeholders are. It's really a case-by-case basis, but in general, you're going to see challenges if the architectural drawings aren't in line with what the construction team is doing, right? Challenges like that. You can see challenges like if a developer doesn't respect the community association, and then the community association kind of fights back and says, we don't want X, Y, and Z development here. And they pull their power together and voice it in a very coordinated effort. They can literally stop projects. They can stop permits from getting passed. Wow. And no projects can go forward, which is great, right? That's the power of it. We don't want one person or a handful of people coming in and making massive changes to cities that others don't want. Or they can compile together and say, all right, for this development, they brought in these vendors, but we're not going to shop there, right? Everything shuts down. There's a lot of different things that could potentially happen.
Sure. And I see that your daughter is very involved. Like she's around and everything that you're all doing, which I think is amazing. So can you talk more about why you decided to have her involved and have her aware of what's going on?
So the truth is, our first deal, I was pregnant with Michaela. So it wasn't really, she was here the whole time. That's why she was here. She's been here the whole time. And so, I mean, literally, she's here right now. And so through that experience, right, she's going to absorb her environment. And her environment has been full of entrepreneurship. Her environment has been full of real estate. She knows our tenants and all that kind of stuff, where she used to. We used to run around a little bit more than we do now. But yeah, like that's important to us, is to expose her to more than just working until you collect a pension, like a lot of us were exposed to at her age. And her understanding finances and money is important, because she is going to probably have more than we did when we were her age, and she needs to know what to do with it. So those types of things are critical. And I think for us, we try to expose her to different things, different opportunities, different cultures, different languages. Like, you know, we're pretty granola in that sense, but it's all about making sure that she's positioned for success, and she knows how to navigate this world, you know, better than we did at her age.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, I can only imagine, you know, by the time she's 18, 20 and up, she's probably take over the whole city.
And we try to make it fun too, she wants to, so she doesn't like rebel, like I'm not gonna work anywhere. But yeah, we try to make it fun. But yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how she grows up and what she find, where she finds her passion and all that kind of stuff.
For sure. And what are your 9-to-5 backgrounds?
Prior to?
Yeah.
When I graduated college, I was extra corporate. So I was in a leadership development program at a Fortune 100 company.
Nice.
So I was doing a lot of like strategic development and organizational change and managing teams and stuff like that. And then my last job was running operations for a software development firm. So I've always been operations, strategy, visionary type stuff.
Yeah. Nice. When I got out of college, my internship had rolled into a full-time position in a HR department, you know, just kind of doing it. I was bouncing around for a little bit. I went from HR to staffing and recruiting and sales-based staff recruiting. And then I worked for a nonprofit for a little while and just kind of getting my feelers out there and getting my legs under me. But every step of the way, I was putting cash away. Making sure that my expenses were substantially lower, than my revenue. I made a lot of sacrifices. I graduated 2010 and, from college, and, I was driving a 1994 Cavalier, and I was sharing a room with a brother, and kind of sacrificing as much as possible, putting every penny away. I had a spreadsheet that said, okay, if I go out on Tuesdays with these guys, I spend too much money. Let me not go out with them anymore. Yeah. Like a little bit of everything. And just, it's just stacking.
For sure. And you two obviously have a lot going on right now. How do you balance everything? Are you currently, do you self-manage your units? Have there been any strategies you've implemented to kind of increase your efficiency as things continue to scale?
Yeah, so for the rentals, we have like an online system that we use for management. So that was helpful in scaling. We implemented that years ago. But now we're at the point where we have like staff and help. So we have some staff that helps with some of the property management. We have some staff that helps kind of here and there with different things, maintenance people, which is helpful. So we've definitely built out our team, and that kind of relieves some of the stress of everyday tasks, so we can focus on things that are a little bit more heavy hitting.
Yeah, it used to be us.
It used to be us, for
sure. And it wasn't that long ago, for real. It was us, like...
Doesn't feel like it. It kind of was.
It was a minute ago.
It was a little while.
I would leave, during my lunch break, go to a house, do a little work.
When was the last time you left your house to do a little work?
It was probably 2016.
It's 2020 now.
Yeah, it's 4 years ago.
That's not that long. That's a long time.
It was like it was yesterday. I mean, we've put pipes in. We've done all kinds of stuff. A little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. Small, little, large. Just getting the job done. Being whatever we needed to be in that moment to keep progressing forward. While working two full-time jobs, while raising a kid.
Yeah.
I was in a graduate MBA program at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a lot.
Yeah. And so now fast forward, now we have, a team have a little bit more process and kind of, so that we can, again, work on our business rather than in it, and really look forward to what it is that we're trying to accomplish and how.
Yeah. Our job now is to be at the 30,000 foot level and make sure it keeps growing.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. And, something else I wanted to discuss. So as you know, of course, Baltimore's gotten a lot of bad press over the years, and it seems like the narrative is changing. So can you talk more about that? Just where the city has, how the city has grown since you two got there, and where you feel it's headed in the future?
Yeah, I mean, Baltimore is, I think, so we were here through Freddie Gray riots and all those types of things. Obviously, Phil's from here, but I was here through that and kind of watched, seeing Baltimore before, during, and after. And what, from my perspective and what I see and the meetings that I sit in or hear Khalil talk about, Baltimore is ripe and ready, right? Baltimore, the change. We said like years ago, we would be on Instagram like, don't be mad when in 5 years from now, when Baltimore looks completely different, and we're cashing in all of those chips, right? Baltimore does look a lot different, and it'll continue to look different because Baltimore has literally been bought and paid for the next 5 to 10 years. And there are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent in the city in every single corridor. And so what people have to know and understand, if you watch every episode and every season of The Wire, I hear you, right? I got you. But I promise you, if you turn off the news and you drive around the city, and not just drive around and kind of look and say, oh, wow, there's vacant, but you come and you go to a housing commission meeting, or you go and check out some, count the cranes, or you go and you see, you go drive around some of the commercial development projects that are being mentioned in the newspaper, you're going to see what's happening, what's changing. Just look up some properties and see how much they sold for a few years ago and how much they're selling for now. Yeah. You're going to see that the things that we've been saying is here, and it's only going to happen more and happen faster. So the best time to invest in Baltimore was probably 5 or 6 years ago, but the next best time is now. And so it's really about, you know, getting out of your own way and just, you know, putting your money towards what, or putting your time, your efforts, your focus towards an area that is like destined to change and to grow. And really, Baltimore is an opportunity, has the opportunity to do that differently than so many other cities have. It's, we can do it in a way where I always say we keep the charm in Charm City, right? We have this opportunity to be able to really dictate what that's going to look like here. And it can look amazing. Like, it can just be Baltimore, you know, keep the essence of Baltimore, but have fresh food, right? Yeah. Like, you know, and just simple stuff, like pushing the city forward, but still keep folks here and keep the essence of Baltimore here. So I'm a big fan, if you can't tell. I think
For sure. Last couple questions. So what does the future look like for you two? I know you mentioned, for one of the big goals is for NextGen to have 220 doors this year. Are there any other big goals that you're working towards?
Yeah, lots. Commercial multis are in our future, more strategic partnerships and a lot of growth, putting people on, putting the city on, making sure that the nation and the world know about Baltimore. You know, the sky's the limit. We want to make sure that we're positioning ourselves to do as much as we possibly can. I have a friend who we were talking one time, and he said when he leaves the earth, he wants to leave on E. I was like, yeah, you know, I love that. That's perfect.
Wow.
That's exactly it.
I like every that. Day, that's a shirt.
Yeah, like there's no way I want to die and be on my deathbed talking about, oh, I wish I could have, would have, should have. Like, nah, you have one life, and that's it. That's all you get. So we want to do as much as we can for our legacy, for other people's legacies, for the city, and make sure that we are doing it in a positive and impactful way.
Yeah, with some vacation sprinkled in the middle.
Gotta have some fun.
Yeah. Lots of treating ourselves.
And do y'all have any events coming up?
We do. So we do a quarterly Mobilize Baltimore meetup. So we typically bring together between 120, 150 people from all over the country. And we talk about investing. We talk about Baltimore. We usually have a topic. So our one in March, the topic is construction, contractors, and managing rehab. So we're getting into the renovation process and how to do that successfully. But we do them quarterly. So if Baltimore is kind of on your list and you want to come on in and, you know, get a hotel, have some fun with it, but get around a lot of great energy, awesome vibes, and network with people who are headed where you want to go. And you'll be around people who have been where you're trying to get to. And so it's a great room to be in. It's always a lot of fun, and tons of information. So that's a great way to just get in the room with us and get in a room with other investors and peers to be able to just talk shop about real estate.
For sure. And can you do a recap of just of the different programs you have going on and the resources and also how people can get in touch with you? We'll definitely be sure to have all that information in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're interested in learning more, connecting with us as part of the NextGen Accelerator and having us help support you on your journey to investing in real estate, specifically in Baltimore, there's an application process. So apply, make sure you put this podcast on as how you found us. But that's definitely number one. We also, you can also check us out on Instagram, on Facebook, Twitter. We have a YouTube channel now where we release information and tips and tricks and all that good stuff weekly. All of those are Charm City Buyers. And of course, charmcitybuyers.com, where you can learn more about Mobilize Baltimore or sign up to be the first to know about the next Mobilize Baltimore meetup. But we're always open books. We share a lot. We have plenty of people sliding in and out of our DMs. you know, reach out. We're here to help. We're here to support people. We want folks to be able to build wealth through real estate. And so whatever we can do to help make that happen is what we're all about.
For sure, for sure. This was an incredible interview. I think the main theme that I continue to think about is just the fact that you two saw that first opportunity in Connecticut. You saw what it could be, and that mentality carried forward in Baltimore, and look where you are now. Not only was it advantageous for you two, but you know, you have a community of people who are able to replicate what you've done and do the same thing in the city. And, you know, I think that first action kind of was like a domino effect to now, you know, you're at a level where you're impacting the whole city. You know, you're helping other investors, you're beautifying the city, now getting into the development and the construction space. So, you know, I'm sure as you drive around, especially as the years go on, you'll be able to see your handprint all over the city and what you did not only for yourselves, but for your daughter and for people and for the city at large. So, I mean, this was a really powerful interview, and so glad that you two made the time to come on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Absolute pleasure. We appreciate you having us. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. And everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And you can also find us on Twitter at Bread Podcast, BRED Podcast. We look forward to talking to you all soon.